The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is hard to check the facts online. Social media feeds are full of hoaxes, fake news, doctored images, and deliberately misleading information. Thankfully, there are journalists and good Samaritans working to debunk fake memes and stories. Those noble efforts raise the question, can you spread the truth as effectively as the viral lies that they expose? That's something Craig Silverman is tackling daily. He's founding editor of BuzzFeed's Canada Bureau, and he's recently taken on a new beat, fake news. Craig, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Now, this is not your first go at debunking fake news. You also founded Emergent. Now, that billed itself as a real-time rumor tracker. What are you doing at BuzzFeed that sets it apart from all of these other online fact-checkers?
Well, I think that there are some great online fact-checkers like Snopes and other places for sure, and there are some that specialize in politics. For us, obviously, BuzzFeed is known for creating content that is very shareable, that goes viral, and it's also known as a place that covers the internet really aggressively and really seriously. And so for me, it's a great opportunity to take some of the lessons that BuzzFeed has learned over the years about, you know, what makes people read things, what makes people share things, how do you create something that really, you know, can go viral, and apply that to some of the foundations of debunking. So the mix of kind of that old school approach of checking stuff out, figuring out what's going on, with some of BuzzFeed's approaches in terms of how we tell stories, but also putting it in formats like quizzes and things like that to actually see if we can get people to engage as much with the debunking, as you said, as much as, you know, the lie or the falsehood.
The quiz I took, I'm happy to report that I am a fake news savant, having guessed 7 out of 8 of them. Why a quiz?
It's one of the things that BuzzFeed does a lot of, obviously. And one of the reasons why BuzzFeed does a lot of quizzes is that people love to take them. They love to do them. They love to share their results. And it's a great, you know, time waster. And so thinking about ways of making the truth spread a bit more, putting it in a format that doesn't seem like, you know, the equivalent of eating your vegetables seems like a good approach. So doing a, you know, is this story fake or real quiz is one way for people who, you know, who may not be engaged on a particular, you know, topic where there's a rumor or a hoax spreading, to actually get exposed to what's going on out there. And I'm hoping to try other kinds of quizzes and other kinds of formats, you know, whether you're writing in a really serious way or you're having fun with something or you're telling it in a more visual way, which one of these things is going to work? And I don't know the answer yet, but it's nice to get a chance to try a bunch of stuff.
Well, some of the things you've done, quick, almost like slideshow style debunkings. There's that photo of a woman covered in blood that has been shared online thousands of times. There's a claim that she's a Trump supporter who was attacked by peaceful liberal protesters at a rally, I think is the quote. You point out she's actually an Australian actress doing a makeup test for a TV show. Other fake bits of online ephemera, like number of anti-trans stories, require more in-depth coverage. So tell us about this phenomenon, how you decide what approach to take when debunking an online hoax.
One of the things that I pay a lot of attention to is why people are sharing something. And so usually people will share something and sort of ignore whether it's true or not if it really closely aligns with, for example, their political beliefs, with their worldview, if it's something that they want to be true. Those are all reasons why somebody is going to kind of put their skepticism down and just sort of push it out there. And so for me, when looking at which ones are worth debunking and how to do it, I want to know what is so appealing about it, because it might actually help me figure out a way to kind of appeal to that same audience to get them to realize, no, wait a minute, that wasn't true. Also, the subject matter is important. You know, you mentioned the anti-trans hoaxes. You know, with North Carolina's bathroom law, we saw a huge amount of hoaxes out there claiming about, you know, encounters, violent encounters often in bathrooms as a result of that, none of which were true. But that's a really serious topic. And so you can't really deal with that in a jokey way. You can't really deal with that in a lighthearted way. So that was more of, you know, a straightforward approach to make sure that people understood that there was a rash of these kinds of anti-trans hoaxes that we're spreading around. So the material is a big thing that dictates it. Another point that's important is also, you know, the exposure that the hoax is getting. So there are a lot of news sites out there that look like real news sites and that put articles out that seem to be real, but they're all hoaxes, and they do that to make money. And so I'm not going to knock down every single thing that these sites publish, because that's arguably going to give them more attention that they're already getting. So there's kind of a threshold that I need to see for certain hoaxes before I'll give the effort and attention to knocking it down. You know, the concern is, am I going to give them more attention than they were already getting?
How about tracing them back to the source? Are you able to actually identify where they came from?
It's usually not too difficult. As I said, there's a lot of these fake news websites, and I know I have a list of them, and I'm constantly checking them to see what they are. But usually, you know, people are sharing stuff, and there might be a link. So, you follow the links back from one place to another, and you can get the origin of it. Sometimes what's a little bit harder is if it's just an image, you know, people claiming that an image shows one thing. You know, it's hard to know the first person who shared that image and made that claim of it, and so sometimes you track things back as far as you can. But it's not too hard to, you know, search on Twitter to see the first person who tweeted something or made a specific claim. And you just kind of triangulate different things from websites, from social media, and from any other source you can find. And a lot of it is that element of just kind of scrolling back, searching, looking to see where this thing came from. Sometimes it's obvious, and sometimes it takes a lot more work.
I'm speaking with Craig Silverman, who has recently taken on the Debunking Hoaxes news beat for BuzzFeed. Well, these things can resurface years later. I've often noticed that, and, you know, sometimes go back to Snopes to look at them, sometimes not. Then that's the problem. Hoaxes travel far and wide online very, very quickly because people love to spread them. Any sense of, like, how fast or how much more they get seen than the stories that debunk them?
Well, one of the things that I did a couple of years ago was a research project at Columbia University where we created a database and a tool where once we saw a story that was unverified, we didn't yet know if it was true or false, we would kind of enter that into our database and we collect all the examples of other places that were reporting that story, and we would watch to see over time as more details came out whether it was proven true or false. And we would look to see and compare the social share numbers. So how many, you know, Facebook shares did the earlier versions of the stories that maybe reported it as true, even though it turned out to be false, get compared to the ones that came later where they actually said, no, this isn't true. And overall, unfortunately, you know, overwhelmingly for the media, there was way more coverage for things when they were in that questionable early stage, when we didn't know if they were true or false, than actually when it was determined that it was finally true or finally false. So I think the end result is that we get exposed to a lot of information that is in that early unverified stage, and that will often turn out to be false, and we will never get the correction. We will never get the debunking to us. It's just way more appealing when it's new, or it's way more appealing when it's a lie, but that lie kind of aligns with what we think is true or what we want to be true. That's when we're interested, and that's when the media spends a lot more time on it.
So what does it take to be a professional debunker?
Well, I guess you kind of have to hate BS is one part of it. Like, you really, I wake up and I'm excited to actually find some stuff that's not true and that people have, you know, willfully or unintentionally put out there. So there has to be some kind of satisfaction and enjoyment from it. The other piece, which, you know, over time you can build up different skills, but on a really basic level, you know, just having the question of, well, where did this come from and who is saying this? Having that basic level of skepticism, I think, is something that you need to have in order to do this. And some good internet research skills also helps. But also, you know, the thing that I found helpful is doing some reading and research in how psychology and sociology play a role in all this. Like, you really need to understand why people are sharing things. You need to understand why people are inclined to believe things. You also need to understand that in times of uncertainty, whether it's a natural disaster or, you know, some event where there's people are not really getting the full picture yet because it's early, humans do have a natural tendency to actually try and formulate theories, which can often turn into rumors, which people will often spread as a way to kind of deal with that uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to kind of appreciate that background. And I think people who, you know, get a lot of pleasure out of doing this kind of work tend to understand the human dynamics at play.
Craig, isn't there a little bit of irony in the fact that you are doing this for BuzzFeed? I mean, BuzzFeed has worked to expand its news coverage, but I do think a lot of old school reporters still perceives the listicles or the funny cat videos as spelling the end of journalism.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that there have been some jokes, and I've seen that. And actually, when I first joined BuzzFeed, and, you know, I've been doing this kind of work for roughly about a decade, there were people, you know, some people who made that comment and other people who thought it was a sign of, you know, how BuzzFeed is taking news and reporting much more seriously. You know, the reality is the lists and the quizzes and things like that, you know, they're meant to be entertainment. And I think there are a lot of media companies, whether it's NBC or, you know, any of the broadcast companies that have an entertainment part and have a news part. For me, it is important that there's a serious news part at BuzzFeed. It is important that there's support, you know, on every level to do this kind of work. And, you know, the other piece that's really, really important and that I paid attention to when I was looking at joining is, you know, how much does BuzzFeed actually care about verifying things on their news team? And so, you know, I do trainings and I help with things internally to make sure that we never get fooled. And that is absolutely a commitment by everybody. You know, no one's going to be perfect. There's a lot of mistakes made every single day by everyone. But there is a commitment to not only make sure that we're not falling for stuff, but to actually invest and put resources into helping other people know what is or isn't true on the internet.
So any big hoaxes we should be on the lookout for right now?
Well, you know, the biggest one that I've been working on over the last couple of days is there's a woman, she's an actress based in Los Angeles, originally from Scotland, who self-published a memoir about her time spent in Zambia in Africa. And she made a lot of claims in an excerpt that was published in a very large UK newspaper about her fleeing from rebels and hiding in the jungle. You know, over the past couple of days, people in Zambia have been raising a lot of questions about this memoir. And so we've been covering this story and I've interviewed her. She hasn't really disputed or given more evidence. But the other interesting thing is she's actually dating the head of the fundraising campaign for Donald Trump. So we have an intersection between Trump and between a memoir that seems to have false and potentially fabricated parts in it.
Well, Craig, thanks for being on the lookout for us.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman, BuzzFeed's Canada editor. He's also heading up the fake news beat for BuzzFeed. You'll find links to some of his debunkings for BuzzFeed, as well as a quiz you can take, which I highly recommend, all at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. They say seeing is believing, but anyone who's witnessed a magic trick or read an article online promising something shocking knows you can't always believe what you see or hear or read. Here's proof from Nate DeMeo and the Memory Palace.
It was the same night, over and over. Tom and Ed would close up the barbershop, grab a couple of six-packs on the way home. Their roommate, Buddy, would show up at some point, clean up after a day at the butcher shop, and they'd all kick back, pop some tops, turn on the radio. They probably didn't have a TV. It was 1953. In whatever the penetration of television ownership in Lithia Springs, Georgia was back then, I'm gonna assume it didn't extend to these three dudes in their 20s. The two buddies from the barbershop, and their friend Buddy, the butcher. So they just hang out, like always. The air thick with humidity, cigarette smoke, cricket song. Some fire hazard electric fan fights a losing battle against the July heat. Moths and summer bugs loiter by the bare bulb on the porch. The same night, over and over. You come home from work, you play some cards, drink some beers, hit the hay. You get up, and you do it all again. Unless you don't. On the night of Wednesday, July 8th, 1953, a police officer named Shirley Brown and his partner were on patrol, driving the back roads of Austell, Georgia, when their headlights caught a pickup truck stopped in the middle of the road. They pulled over and found three thoroughly freaked out young men. And the strangest thing the two veterans of the Cobb County Police Department had ever seen in their lives. There, sprawled out on the blacktop, was a 2-foot-long creature. And damn if that thing didn't look like a dead alien. The story, told breathlessly by the side of the road, red police lights sweeping round and round through the trees, went like this. The three guys, the two barbers, Buddy the butcher, were out just driving around in their truck when a flying saucer came out of nowhere. Just bam, there it was, in the middle of the road, glowing all red, you know, like they do. And there were these three little aliens, three little Martians or moon men or Venusians, just skittering around. So the fellas jam on the brakes, and the spacemen scatter. But one of them goes the wrong way. And, you know, roadkill. Then the other two ran back into the saucer, and then the lights in the thing go from red to blue, and just zoom. The thing whizzed up and away. Officer Brown and his partner surveyed the scene. There was indeed one green alien-looking thing. Humanoid. Big old crazy-looking eyes. And there were skid marks consistent with the truck stopping short to avoid striking an object in the road, like a deer, or a downed power line, or a box spring that fell off the back of a mattress truck, or an extraterrestrial. And right where the three guys said the spaceship turned all blue and then whooshed up into the night, there were circular burn marks in the road from the space blasters or their propulsion system or what have you. They called it into the station, and they let the boys go. Told them to head right home. Told them they could keep the alien. So the guys went back to the apartment, cleared out some space in the fridge for the ET, and called the paper. Next thing you know, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution has got the butcher, the two barbers, and the alien on its front page, with quotes from a veterinarian who said, indeed, whatever this thing was, it was most likely something out of this world. As was the response. The story hit the wires, and soon, the world knew that three young men from Lithia Springs, Georgia, had just captured a creature from another planet. This is the scene in the black and white movie where the newspapers spin around and then stop for a second to show you the headline. UFOs land outside of Atlanta. Spin, spin, spin. Flying saucer man captured. Spin, spin, spin. Doctor confirms it's something out of this world. Cut to reporters in shirt sleeves and fedoras with press cards sticking out of their hat bands as they roll their Studebakers up some neighbor's lawn and hop out and sprint to take pictures of the dazed young men in their front steps. Giant flashbulbs popping, and the kids in the neighborhood are running around with tinfoil hats, looking up at the sky with telescopes they bought with box tops. Some pretty mom in a gingham dress and a frilly white apron faints. Probably drops a pie. And for a while there, in the second week of July, 1953, people thought it finally happened. That thing they'd seen in the movies, it was real. The flying saucers came, and they didn't pick the White House. They didn't zap the Eiffel Tower. They landed right there in Lithia Springs. And then a day or two later, a different vet took a look at the alien and said, if this is a Martian, then they have monkeys on Mars. And then the jig was up. There was an article in the paper the next week, lays out the whole thing, how the barbers and their buddy, Buddy, the butcher, were bored one night, playing cards, drinking beers, same old. And one of them, one of the barbers, bet his buddies $10 that he could get his name in the paper. Next thing they know, they're buying a rhesus monkey at the pet store because, I don't know, there was a rhesus monkey at the pet store. They're giving the poor thing a lethal dose of chloroform in a full body shave. The butcher cuts off its tail. Someone finds an old bucket of green paint. Someone burns a UFO-like circle in the pavement with a blowtorch. And then, next thing you know, the other barber and the butcher are out $5 each. Not long after that, the barber who won the bet was 40 in the hole. He got fined $50 for blocking traffic. And that was that for the barbers and the butcher and the alien. Everyone else in town went about their business, put away their tinfoil hats, cleaned up the fallen pie from the linoleum, punched back in at the plant, told everyone that they never believed it anyway. They knew from the get-go that it was all a hoax. Just some good old boys, never meaning no harm. But don't believe them. Or most of them, anyway. Because they believed it. At least for a minute there. Because they had seen those movies where the spaceman lands. And people were talking about UFOs all the time back then. And just a few nights before the incident, people saw some strange lights near Marietta. Swore that there was definitely something there in the sky. They saw it with their own eyes. Or at least their cousin did. That guy at the diner. So basically everyone. But they said they never believed it. So they talked big. They made fun of the three perpetrators whenever they'd run into them at the barber shop or the butcher shop. They were relentless. Eventually it got so bad that one of the guys moved out of town. rather than have his neighbors rag on him for being the monkey hoax guy for the rest of his life. Which seems extreme. Because really, why feel bad about being the monkey hoax guy? Forget those people. And why would those people make fun of the monkey hoax guy? Are people mad because these three guys fooled everybody? Because they got all that attention? I think maybe they were ticked because these three guys knew something they didn't. Or at least they remembered something that the rest of them had forgotten along the way. That it's the same damn thing every damn day. You get up, you go to work. You come home, you drink some beers, play some cards, pack some lunches, smoke some cigarettes, walk the dog, put your curlers in, hit the hay, and you do it all over again. Unless you don't. The two barbers, the butcher, they took some regular Wednesday night, and then they had themselves a night. And they gave a whole lot of people most of a whole week, where it wasn't the same thing every day. Everybody wins. Except the monkey.
That story came to us from Nate DeMeo and the Memory Palace. You'll find a link to more of his stories at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Guy de Maupassant's 19th century novel Pierre et Jean transformed narrative fiction. Written in his native Normandy on France's rugged north coast, the story of two brothers upended the role of the author as judge of character. He was instead an observer of life and the intense psychological complexity of a family torn apart by envy and lies. In his adaptation of the book, New England filmmaker Jay Craven also breaks with custom, making an historical feature film with college students rather than Hollywood professionals on a shoestring. The result, Peter and John, is showing in theaters around New Hampshire, beginning with Red River Theaters in Concord on July 14th. And Jay Craven, filmmaker and director of the Vermont-based Kingdom County Productions, joins us in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So you set this film in Nantucket, 1872, in what is known as the ghost period of the island. What does that mean?
Well, it's after the fall of whaling, really, and also after the Civil War, and before the rise of tourism and any kind of development. So it was a period where the population had shrunk to probably 2,500 or maybe 3,000 people, where there were just the questions about what the future held for the island, people really not sure. Wages were low. They were lower than on the mainland. And that was true right into the early 20th century. So it was a period of uncertainty for Nantucket, which had had this great opulent period as the whaling capital, really, of the world. It was gone, and the post-Civil War was continuing to linger. There was drug addiction, which, you know, a lot of soldiers came back from the war addicted to opium. And it plays a little bit as a subtext in the film in terms of Peter's future, especially. He's trying to make a practice as a medical doctor, and it's a little bit on shaky ground, and he's not making a lot of money. And, you know, it only amplifies some of the other questions that he faces.
And I do really want to get to the story,
yeah.
But the process, I think, is so interesting here. You should
sure.
have shot it on Nantucket. With students, where did these students come from? Tell us about this program.
Well, Movies from Marlboro is a program I started in 2012 and made a film called Northern Borders with Bruce Dern and Geneviève Bujold that year. And the idea was to bring students together for a film intensive semester at Marlboro College, students from a dozen different colleges. We spend the first 8 weeks in classes, literature class, cinema studies, screenwriting, directing class, also in departments, production design, production management, camera, light, sound, hair and makeup, post-production. And then after that 8 weeks, plunge into a very ambitious feature film project for 6 weeks of every day, 14-hour days production on Nantucket.
I saw the Kickstarter video, the fundraising video,
uh-huh.
featuring some of the students doing this work. They were doing everything, you know, doing
yeah.
the costumes, doing everything. And Is that the goal, so that they know a little bit about all of filmmaking?
That is the goal. I mean, students will tend to find a home in one of the departments, but we do provide for flexibility where they can try their hand at a different department. So we had a young woman who was working in the camera, light, sound department, but wanted to come and do script supervising for a while. Some students stay hooked on the same job the entire time. But yes, we had a prop master from Mount Holyoke College, sophomore, who was given access by the Nantucket Historical Association to 35,000 artifacts in their warehouse going back to the 16th century, and who was able to draw anything that worked for the script. I mean, what a fabulous opportunity. And likewise, costumes. Costumes were a huge deal in this particular film, and especially when our leading actress didn't like the first round and we had to continue shuffling them through and acquiring them and shipping them from Los Angeles and doing all this research, because costumes are a big part of this film.
How do you then, Jay, as a filmmaker, you know, putting all this time and energy and story and getting these actors, how do you make sure that it doesn't look like a student film? Like, what do you do?
Well, that's key. The plan is that students are being stretched to reach beyond their grasp to make an ambitious professional film. It is not that the professionals are looking to go to the student level and simply, you know, make an amateur film. I mean, one could do that, and there'd be nothing wrong with it for students to be totally out front as the writers, the directors, and every other thing. This model is a different model. This model is that students are reaching to work as peers with professionals. And generally speaking, within 4 days of the start of production, they are functioning as peers, and they're respected as such by the professionals. And there's something truly substantial gained in that experience for the students, the amount of responsibility they're given, the rhythm of daily production, which is at a professional standard, all of that we find to be beneficial. In my experience, the culture of these shoots are the best I've experienced. They're fun because the young people are thrilled with the sort of first experience part of it, and the mentors are generous towards the kids. And that's a wonderful dynamic to be a part of. And so it's really quite pleasurable. But yes, we set out to make the best movie we can.
And your lead actress in this case is Jacqueline Bisset.
Yes, the great Jacqueline.
Yes, you know, this is a woman who's worked with Francois Truffaut, John Huston, George Cukor. What's the interest for her in doing a, quote, small film like this?
Well, I think she likes to work. I think that she responded to the script for sure. And in fact, I'd had a funny contact with her 10 years earlier that she didn't remember, where we'd talked about this story, strangely enough. And she finally said, you know, but I have this book on my bookshelf and I have no idea. I'm meant to do this film. I said, I sent you the book 10 years ago. She responded to the idea of the story, to a big character. I mean, she really is a lead character here. And older actors don't get a lot of lead roles. I mean, Bruce Dern was the same thing in our previous film. It was a leading role for an older actor that really challenged them. And so I think that she thought it would be interesting, that she could do substantial work, that she could flex some of her muscles. And I think she does. I think she's really terrific in the film. So.
Wow. And in another defiance of the Hollywood model, it appears that she has allowed herself to age naturally.
That's right. And she has resisted. Well, she doesn't. She's had no plastic surgery. She does not use Botox. That's a point of personal pride. However, she's an actress who was so defined for so many years by her look.
And in this film, she is the mother of these two boys,
right,
Peter and John. I'm just going to play a clip from a scene where she is speaking to Lucia, who is, both of the brothers are sort of vying for. And in the beginning of the film, you could think that this is going to be a film about their rivalry for a woman, but it becomes
right.
About something quite different.
Girls are raised to marry. They not always need to understand the compromise until later.
Of course we are. We sell to the right bidder and pray for love to follow.
You were married. Betray yourself and you will find yourself betraying others.
I understand.
Good.
Jacqueline Bisset and Diane Guerrero, a young actress that people may know the name from Orange is the New Black, the Netflix series. That's a clip from the film Peter and John, made by my guest, filmmaker Jay Craven, and a number of students in a very intensive process. So what was going on in that scene, Jay?
Well, both Peter and John are vying for the affections of Lucia, who was a Cuban expatriate who moved with her family to northern Florida, and then after the Civil War sort of left that after a fairly tumultuous experience of the Civil War itself, which was all based on research and a true story, her character was. So in this scene, there's been a resolution in terms of which of the boys is sort of able to win the affections of Lucia, and Louise Roland, the mother, steps in to have a discussion, a brief moment with Lucia to sort of impart her perspective, her wisdom, her reticence, and ultimately her support for the next steps that will take place with the sons.
And it's a knowing way. She says, betray yourself. And you will betray others. And she is really the central character in this.
Right.
There are a lot of secrets in this family.
That's right. A lot of secrets in the family, and that's a theme in the story as a whole, and how those secrets ignite these conflicts and emotional dynamics between the characters, and how for Peter, who is also plays opposite, really, his mother. I mean, to the extent that we're used to romantic drama, here you have this very charged emotional relationship, a too close relationship, really. And it's something that Maupassant was very interested in. In fact, Maupassant thought that he was the illegitimate son of Flaubert.
Wasn't it his uncle or his godfather or something?
It was sort of Flaubert? His godfather, yes, who became close to the family. His own father left the family when he was very young, and Flaubert became very important to him, and he sort of assumed that he was his father. But it was never clarified, articulated, and Maupassant died fairly young. But so this theme of legitimacy was something that was on Maupassant's mind in several of his stories.
And with New England propriety, you know, as the background there.
Absolutely.
Interesting transition. Did you write the screenplay for it from the book?
Yes. I wrote the screenplay. And then we spend, as I say, 8 weeks with 6 hours a week of debating, revising, discussing, looking at gender roles, racial representations, everything else to sort of fill it out and provide ownership for the students as well. Mm-hmm. So the scene actually where Lucia is explaining her background, how she got to Nantucket and what happened in her family, something students researched and wrote, for example.
And she, as a Confederate widow, never mind being a Cuban, clearly not looking like all of the other islanders, is in a precarious position.
Absolutely, and knows it. Despite the fact that Nantucket, and this is where we draw some of the history, it was the site of the first abolition society in the world. Frederick Douglass made his first public speech in Nantucket. But there were divisions on the island. And there was a part of the island, which Lucia discovers very early on her arrival, that is intended for people of color.
So many layers of, you know, New England history, but also psychology. Why did you decide on adapting this novel for a film?
Well, that's why. I'd worked in Nantucket mentoring high school kids in screenwriting and filmmaking for the Nantucket Film Festival and for the Nantucket Athenaeum. So I had some connections to the island. The actor Chris Noth, who was a Marlborough College graduate, actor from Sex and the City.
Who went on to be Mr. Big on Sex and the City.
That's right, Mr. Big, is a Marlborough College alumnus and agreed to come to Nantucket to do a benefit event for us. And I was being interviewed, actually, by the Enquirer and Mirror, the newspaper in Nantucket. And the question came up, well, why don't you make a film on Nantucket? Have you ever thought of that? And in the very moment, I said, yes. And she said, what? And I said, Peter and John. And I just sort of grabbed it out of thin air and suddenly found myself committed to making this movie. Because this is my eighth feature film. I'd made six films in Vermont and New Hampshire, frankly, because each of my Vermont films included some scene shot in New Hampshire because we straddle the border in the Northeast Kingdom. And so I'd always been a North Country filmmaker, and my films have been called Westerns, you know, the early films. And so the idea of doing something totally different, totally new appealed to me. And when I thought of Nantucket, I immediately thought of period because it is a restored whaling community, and 19th century is written all over the place. And so I said then, and Peter and John, which was distinctly a seaside story and really depended on that aspect. So
how much did you make it for in the end?
$750,000, which is a very low budget. And so I'd made six movies on budgets of $2 million. And it just increasingly didn't work. It was better 20 years ago than it is now. And so to continue making films, there was this question of how to finance it and to do so without involving investors who are just going to be at risk. And so this model of working with students and then nonprofit fundraising, I mean, my company is a nonprofit arts organization, is the only way, but it's something that we believe in strongly, both the educational mission and the idea of place-based New England filmmaking.
Well, I want to ask you about that. I mean, why did you stay in New England? I mean, if you had aspirations as a filmmaker and wanted to make movies, why are you way up there in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont?
Well, it's totally what appealed to me, the idea of making movies where we are. You know, that Hollywood should not have a monopoly on all the movies that get made. That we can make movies, that we can work with industry actors, which we do, but also work with regional actors, and tell good stories, compelling stories, what I would call cultural rather than commercial cinema. And cultural cinema has a great tradition. I mean, European films. I mean, even some American films. We could call Spike Lee's movie cultural films. We could call Wes Anderson's films, you know, because they're drawing from character and place. But cultural cinema does not fare particularly well in the hyper-commercialized Hollywood industry. So let's make movies right here, build an infrastructure, barnstorm them throughout the region. That's a big part of what we do, too, is to play between 100 and 200 venues in New England. And to continue to try to develop those audiences and those venues and alternate venues, not just movie theaters, town halls, you know, fire stations, cafes, and to really keep cinema alive as a force.
Jay Craven, thank you for being here to tell us about it.
Well, thank you.
Jay Craven is the filmmaker and director of Kingdom County Productions. The new film, Peter and John, is showing in theaters around New Hampshire, beginning with Red River Theaters in Concord on July 14th, then on to Wilton Town Hall, The Hop at Dartmouth, and the Portsmouth Music Hall. Details on all the showtimes and the Movies from Marlborough program and deadlines for applications for its next run at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's summer, and classes may be out, but for many high school students, questions about their future continue to loom large. 18-year-old radio rookie Cece Rodriguez knows that the military is a man's world. Women are a slight 6% of her target branch, the Marine Corps, and tend to hold lower-ranking positions there than in other branches of the military. For Cece, that challenge is part of the appeal.
18. 19. That's 20. We are slow.
I might have spaghetti arms, but I work out hard. I'm 5'4" and 100 pounds. I may be tiny, but there's a bigger me inside this little me.
That's like 7. Ah.
I can already pass the Marine Corps physical fitness test. For pull-ups, I can do 20. And push-ups, I can do 30 of those. But I want to be in shape to get that max score.
I can't no more.
I've always been competitive, like on the basketball court.
You don't know the rules of basketball, and you don't even know what you're talking about. All right, give me the record book, and I'll show you
I guess
way.
You could say...
She's stubborn, hard-headed, coconut head.
That's my smart mouth of a friend, Gabby. But even though I might have a coconut head, I can accept authority when I need to. I understand what I'm getting into when I talk about joining the Marines. A lot of my family members have served in the armed forces, but that doesn't mean they want me to join. Actually, it's kind of the opposite.
How would you feel about seeing me leave?
I'd cry a lot. I wouldn't want you to leave. And I'll freaking hang you in my closet so you won't leave.
My younger sister Sarai cried when our brother left for the Marines.
Are you trying to kill me?
I'm gonna ziplock you in a bag.
Ziploc me in a bag.
I don't want you to go to the Marines like you're my favorite sister. Why would I ever want that?
My mom has her own worries about it.
A parent never imagines a child telling them that they want to go into the forces. That's a parent's worst nightmare. You know, you have to have the mentality of thinking, I might go to war if this is for me, because war is not for everybody.
I think of this all the time.
Okay. Because there's PTSD and all that other stuff when people come, because Max didn't come so good.
My stepfather Max fought in Iraq. My mom says when he came back, he wasn't the same Jokey Max who left for the Marines.
He was my best friend. Before he left, he was a certain way, and when he came back, he was totally different. That wasn't Max no more.
I try not to worry about PTSD, not because I don't think it can happen to me, but because serving is an honor. I want to enlist for my family, to protect them. and they're worth the risk of going to war. Or even losing my life.
Nobody is ever ready for the military.
Max told me that getting on the plane to go to Iraq was hard, but getting off was harder. He doesn't only worry that I might have to go to war, but also about the fact that I'm a female.
Recently on the news, there was a lot of rapes going on within the military. Females would either say something to their senior and then their senior would dismiss it for whatever reason.
When we went to one of the higher ups, the chain of command, they told me just because I didn't like somebody, they weren't going to switch me away from this guy.
I know that rape is a big problem in the military, but I don't really know how it's even allowed to happen.
He tried to get me to touch him.
So I watched this documentary. It's called The Invisible War.
And started to yell for the other guys to kind of hear me, to hey, hey, hey. He hit me across the left side of my face.
The film is legit depressing. You hear about these women getting beaten, and the guys are just chilling as if they did nothing wrong. When I got home, I talked to my mom about the movie.
Was the movie what you expected it to be?
Well, the ladies that got raped for a long time. Like,
how you feel about that and you wanting to go into the military?
There's a lot of women there, it depends, you know, and I would defend myself. Like, if they don't defend me, I'm defending myself first. I would carry a knife, a gun, some damn pepper spray, all of them, huh? Like, if you don't get stabbed, then you're getting shot up. If you can't get shot up, you're getting stabbed up. And if you can't get neither, you're getting sprayed up in your eyes. Yeah, I know. I sound tough. But a federal investigation found 23% of women in the military say they've experienced unwanted sexual contact. That's a lot. And the fact that I'm small could make me vulnerable. I'm not gonna let that stop me. I don't want to see myself as a victim when I haven't even become one. Not everyone gets put through that.
I always felt safe. And I don't think I remember a time when any of my female friends had any issues that where they felt unsafe.
Sandra Garfinkel is a former Marine.
The thing about the Marine Corps is that I feel it's it's a boys' club. And I wanted to do everything I could to not be seen as a woman, but to be seen as a Marine so I could be equal. And I did everything 110% just to blend in. But there was a lot of that being either treated with a little bit of resentment because sometimes women get better birthing or we don't have to get as high of a physical fitness test score or they just don't believe that we should be there.
I have zero tolerance for people who think women aren't capable of doing a man's job. If I end up having a sexist commanding officer, first, I speak with him. If that doesn't work, I'm speaking with the person above him. Even that boss has a boss, and I will find him. I went to check out the Marine recruiting headquarters on Long Island to see where I'll be one day.
Christina, nice to meet you. Come on up.
That's cool.
So this space that we just walked through here is 2nd Battalion 25th.
I truly feel ready to do this.
And they are actually
and boot camp is calling my name.
See.
Thank you.
Go. I'm telling you, this is pretty cool. What? I'm gonna be a Marine. I'm proud to say that.
For WNYC, I'm rookie reporter CC Rodriguez.
CC's story was produced by Radio Rookies. That's all we have time for today, but just a note before we go. If you ducked into a corner at the school library to read Judy Blume's books or devoured them by flashlight under the covers at night, you are not alone. For millions of American girls, nothing softened the humiliating passage from childhood to adolescence better than Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, or Forever. I'll be speaking with Judy Blume for Writers on a New England Stage this Thursday at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, and we'll talk with her about her role as the antithesis of the mean girl having her books banned and her most recent book, In the Unlikely Event, which was written for grown-ups. There's more information at the show at wordofmouthradio.org. And meanwhile, you can post your favorite Judy Blume book on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow at 2, right here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.